Hello, Joe Klein.
Hey David, how are you?
I'm well. Welcome to Blogging Heads. This is your first time, I understand.
Yes, I am a Blogging Heads virgin.
So we'll all be gentle. I hope the commenters will be gentle. I've done this a few times, but that doesn't mean I'm good at it.
Well, I'm sure you'll be civil about it, as I will.
All right. So what we want to talk about today, we've got some important decisions. Coming, obviously, on Afghanistan. We are moving toward a state of crisis on Iran, and there are some important decisions here in Washington to be made about both of those issues. You've obviously thought about these things very hard. You've been a recent visitor to Afghanistan, I know. Maybe you want to start by sharing some of your thoughts on those questions, and we'll take it from there.
Right. Well, I'll start by disputing whether we have a looming crisis about Iran. I think that Iran is a second-level threat, even if it eventually gets a nuclear weapon. It's kind of funny. I was there in 2001 in Tehran when Rafsanjani called for an Islamic bomb to counter Israel's nuclear capacity. But even then, that was the boldest statement that was ever made by an Iranian on this issue. But even then, he just saw it as a deterrent. And, one thing that we know about the Iranians, although we don't know all that much about the Iranians, is that in their international interactions, they've been pretty reasonable in the defense of what they perceive to be their own national security interests. And I think that they perceive a threat from Israel, and they want to have some sort of deterrent to that. Although I'm not convinced that they're going for the bomb itself, I'm with those who think that it's more likely that they're going for breakout capability, which is what Japan presumably has, the ability to put together a bomb if it becomes necessary.
Well, here's why I would describe it as a looming crisis, that the sanctions projects have not succeeded. The last round of effort ended pretty ignominiously. I think the minds are adjusting to the choice that it's at this point it's probably a military option or it's some kind of acceptance of the reality of an Iranian bomb. And people who know Israeli politics better than I do say it's impossible for Israel to accept it, which means they have to act. And if they're going to act, they want to act sooner rather than later, because sooner means you catch them farther away from that breakout capability you mentioned. So the Obama administration may be about to be handed a unilateral Israeli action. And some straws in the air on that point are, first, this recent visit of Prime Minister Netanyahu to Washington, completely private, without an agenda, and a long meeting. And second, this strange statement from the Iranian President Ahmadinejad earlier in the week, where he said the United States has to choose between Iran and Israel, suggesting that he also perceives some kind of fork in the road coming. So I'm looking at those things and thinking, I don't know, the air is getting very crackly.
I disagree about that. First of all, we should lay down a couple of predicates. The U.S. the U.S. military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, are unanimously opposed to any sort of U.S. military action. We should make that clear. I'm not sure where the Israelis are on this, but the idea of U.S. military action, even though we always say everything's on the table, it really isn't on the table, because the military is determined that the blowback from any kind of U.S. strike in Iran would be not worth, the effects. As for the Israelis, I think that it's on us to send them a very, very clear message that if they do this, that we will, we will not respond fondly. We will not give them clearance, or not ask for clearance for them to fly over, Arab lands, and our military aid to Israel will be on the table. I think that we have to use that threat, because if they do this, it's going to create tremendous instability in the region, and tremendous instability on its borders. Now, there are other things that Israel can do, and other things that we should do, I believe. I think that you may be right about the sanctions ending badly in this case, although the folks in the White House seem to think that the Russians are on board. I don't think the Russians are on board, but they do. But if the Russians aren't on board, and you can't count on the Chinese, I think that a program of containment and deterrence is the way to go. And I would very broadly define, you know, the containment part of it. I would, you know, be in favor of U.S. support for Israeli operations that intercept arms going to Hezbollah. There was a ship intercepted a few a few weeks ago with a major cache of arms that was headed for Hezbollah. I would support those sort of operations. I think that that's something that we do. And finally, on Ahmadinejad, at this point, who cares what he says? It's very clear that he's not the guy making the decisions. If he were, we would have a nuclear deal based on the negotiations in Geneva.
Well, let me just say a couple of points there. Your assessment of the U.S. end of it is clearly right. I mean, I've been predicting and writing since, I think, 2005, there would be no U.S. strike. And at this point, it wouldn't matter what the Joint Chiefs said. President Obama is obviously not a strike-ordering kind of guy. That's not going to happen. That said, if the Israelis do decide they need to proceed, I don't know that they are going to be hugely impressed by an Obama administration edict not to do it. Partly because I think politically, imagine it does happen. Imagine that the Israelis do strike. And now imagine that President Obama, who is a popular president, but whose ratings on national security issues are low, who is, by the way, going to depend on Republican votes to carry out his strategy in Afghanistan, that he is going to try to put some kind of sanction on Israel at this point in his presidency. It seems to me that would just collapse in ignominy. The reaction in public opinion would be pro-Israel. The reaction in Congress would be hugely pro-Israel. The reaction among Republicans in Congress, especially hugely pro-Israel. What happens to his Afghanistan strategy? What happens to the rest of his foreign policy? What happens, for example, to his ability to get some kind of climate change accord through Congress without red revolution, blue revolution? If he is trying to impose sanctions on Israel, I find it inconceivable that he would succeed in doing such a thing. And that makes me think that he wouldn't try. This has not been a very forceful kind of presidency to date. If the first demonstration of presidential muscle flexing is against an Israel that has struck a nuclear facility in Iran, boy.
Well, you know, David, I think that there has been presidential muscle flexing, only not on Israel. I think that, you know, the feeling around the White House is that the Middle East policy has been a complete and utter failure. But perhaps it's been a failure because the president demanded things without saying or else, without, you know, saying if you don't stop settlement building, we're going to withhold economic aid as the Bush administration did 20 years ago. I agree with you that Netanyahu at this point, the Israelis at this point, really feel that they have Obama's number and that he hasn't seemed that strong. But he is kind of a willing-to-strike kind of guy. Just look at the predator strikes on the Afghan-Pakistan border. The numbers of predator strikes since Obama has been president, you know, are an order of magnitude greater than they were during the Bush presidency. You know, he was willing to take action against those pirates. He may be willing to bolster the force in Afghanistan. He certainly doubled down on it within months after he took office. So I think, you know, he is, you know, if the implication is that he's some kind of a foreign policy wimp, I think that he's thoughtful, he's judicious, and he's willing to use force in areas where he really believes it's necessary.
You think that if there were an Israeli strike, they wouldn't have to go through Iraq. They might be able to go through Saudi Arabia, which would require a lot of secret diplomacy. But given how the Saudis feel about the Iranian program, not inconceivable. If that were to happen, do you think that Obama would try, and do you think he would succeed in imposing any kind of punishment on Israel?
I don't know that he tried, but I certainly hope that he would, because I think that we have to think about the effects and options here. What would be the effect if Israel did that? I think that you would immediately have, a major Hezbollah response on the northern border of Israel, but you would also have a response potentially against us in Iraq. You know, the IRGC, Quds force is just across the border. So there would be a, you know, I don't think that the Iranians would distinguish between Israel and the United States, because I think that they believe that we can control Israel. I don't know why they believe that, because we can't seem to control anybody else. But I do think that there would be a response on our troops in Iraq. There might be terrorist attacks here against us. Hezbollah is a far more effective and global terrorist force, I think, than Al-Qaeda is. And so I think that in advance of an Israeli strike, the president would use every last bit of pressure he could muster to try and dissuade them. I also
do you think that's
want
what
to return to the initial point.
Do you think that's what they're talking about? Do you think that's what he and Netanyahu talked about in this recent visit?
I don't think that Netanyahu is planning a strike anytime soon. In fact, I think that what may be going on here is, you know, it's quite possible. The Israelis and we have been very successful in terms of sabotage of the Iranian nuclear program. The enrichment program has been blocked and neutered for a number of years. And there's real talk that, and we don't know, obviously, but it's entirely possible that the reason why Iran was willing to go into the deal, the nuclear deal, is that the fuel that they enriched has serious imperfections. At least that's what you hear. So I don't know that Netanyahu is pushing for a nuclear strike at this point. I think, though, that it serves his interests very well to keep that threat alive. And it certainly is something that the Iranians have to worry about. Another really important thing about Iran, and I've noticed that both times that I've been there, they took a million casualties in the Iran-Iraq war. That is still the most important component in Iranian domestic policy and foreign policy. You know, of those casualties, there were there were 160,000 deaths and over 800,000, wounded, including, chemical victims of the war. And so my sense of, the Iranian people is that they're not going to rise up in revolution against this odious regime for that reason. But I think that the odious regime really doesn't want another war anytime soon.
That's interesting. All the talk that we're hearing from the Israelis that we're going to have to do it, that those are just words? And
I think it's really smart.
if
I'm an Israeli,
it's not smart to make threats and then not follow through on them, because time passes and the first couple of times you do it, everyone's very impressed. But it's a little bit like this is what happened to the Bush administration. They kept threatening the Iranians with severe consequences, and there never were any severe consequences. And by the end, it all become a rather grimly comic outcome. You can't do that forever. You either have to not make the threats in the first place or eventually be prepared to carry them out. And I don't even think the Israelis understand that basic grammar of schoolyard credibility.
Yeah, but David, I'm not sure. You may know better than I. I don't know that they have directly officially made any threats. I think that they've done this in a way that they often do it, and which is to let rumors circulate. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the past when they've taken action, we haven't heard a thing about it before it happened. Not with the strike on Syria, which I favored, by the way, not with the strike on the nuclear facility in Iraq. So this is different behavior on the part of the Israelis, and I'm just not, I don't know that I've heard either Netanyahu or Olmert before him make any sort of official threat against Iran.
Could
be wrong.
No, you're absolutely right about that. No, it's more what they say when they're doing, they're going around the Washington briefing circuit, think tanks and so on, and it's not that kind of person, but it's senior military people, retired senior military people, intelligence people, and they say, we're serious. And you say we're serious enough times, and then you do things that aren't serious, then people think, I guess when they say they're serious, they're joking.
Right. But I do think that you have to make that, make that division between actual remarks by people in power and the line that's being trotted out by the think tank community. By the way, my feeling about Israel's opinion of Iran, especially among people who are not on the handling the levers of power, is that they are understandably freaked out by Iran, mostly because of the more immediate threat on their borders, Hezbollah and Hamas. And that would lead to a kind of jittery reaction of the sort that we usually never see from the Israelis, but we're seeing now. I just don't know that it should be taken totally seriously. You want to move on to Afghanistan?
Yes, please.
Well, I think the news today is Ambassador Eikenberry standing up against his former military colleagues, and I know Eikenberry pretty well, and I have tremendous respect for the guy. He is he's a man of real honor. I don't know whether I agree with his prescription at this point, and the process as it's going on right now is easy to criticize because it's gone on for a long time and it's been unduly public. But I think that the sort of questions that are being raised are first order questions about Afghanistan that really need to be raised. When I talk to people like General Petraeus and others in the military, they are happy that this sort of review is going on. They're happy that the questions are being raised. I think that they have a point of view about the result. What I'm hearing is that Petraeus is the most vehement advocate of McChrystal's 40,000 troop formula in the meetings of the National Security Council. The other thing I'm hearing is that all of these numbers that you hear about the president supporting or not supporting are not true. Even Obama's closest aides don't have any idea where he's going to go with this at this point.
Let's go more to the first order and the whole Afghan problem. Remind me when you were there.
I was last there in April. I was there before that. I've been there twice in the last year. You were there, I think, just shortly before me, right?
Right, but exactly a year ago. But I was touring. You were with the U.S. personnel. I saw very few Americans when I was there. I was mostly with NATO.
Me too. I the second time I saw Americans, the first time I traveled with Egon Rahms, the NATO commander above then McKiernan.
Right. Okay. I was on one of those NATO trips as well. We met a few Americans. I was there in October, and just to to situate that, October of 2008, and candidate Obama had been there in July of 2008.
Right.
And we were often in his footsteps, meeting people he had previously met. And there was very little going on when we were there in October that is different from the situation now. And indeed, I was in the presidential palace, talking to the Karzai team on the very day that the New York Times printed that big story detailing all of the narcotics transactions of Karzai's brother, and a story that was so where people in government had deliberately left their fingerprints on it, like just they then put an extra thumb on the document and sort of rubbed it around just to make sure that the fingerprint was clearly legible, that this was an official leak from the highest levels of authority, and they looked quite stricken. But the point was, in October of 2008, everybody knew all about the Karzai family and how they earned their living.
Right, they did, and there has been real. The fact is that Richard Holbrooke was hired for a reason. He's called the bulldozer. And in this case, as with Netanyahu, the United States really didn't have the quid pro quo to force Karzai to do anything differently from the way he's been doing it. The current situation has been compounded this year, though, by some really serious military mistakes. About the time that you were there last year, in fact, the months before it, General McKiernan, General McNeil, and others decided that the next stage of the battle would be to put troops into Helmand province, where the opium is, and which was essentially in control of the Taliban. This you know, this was then done. They built all the fortifications while you and I were both there, and between October and December last year. And it became a fait accompli. It became like a super tanker that they couldn't move. And by the time McChrystal took over in June, the troops were already landing in Helmand province. And at one of his very first briefings, McChrystal looks around the room and he says, "Why are the Marines in Helmand?" And the answer is that that was a very conventional way to look at the war. You go, you put your troops where the bad guys are. Counterinsurgency doctrine argues the exact opposite, which is that you put the troops where the population is. The center, the fulcrum of this insurgency is in Pashtun lands, and the capital of Pashtunistan is Kandahar. The troops should have gone there. Every military person I talk to, with the exception of one, agrees with that, or they've told me that. And, you know, now I think that everybody also agrees that we have to put some troops in Kandahar City as quickly as possible. But that's been a problem, and also the military has moved incredibly slowly when it comes to setting up training companies to work with Afghan battalions. There isn't a single joint unit operation going on in Afghanistan now. That's astonishing.
Well, there are a lot of training missions, but the whole NATO thing is stuff. So you'll have a situation where ordinary soldiers are being trained by Canadians, NCOs are being trained by the British, and senior officers are being trained by the French, all of them with their own doctrines, presumably with all kinds of linguistic challenges. And this is for an army that is going to be ending up fighting mostly alongside Americans who have quite different doctrines from the Canadians, the British, and the French, and the Germans, Germans and Dutch.
It's been a real mess. And, you know, going back to Iraq, I mean, the places that the surge worked best, the places the counterinsurgency worked best, were those neighborhoods where you had joint security stations where the Iraqis and the Americans lived and patrolled together. What I'm talking about here is that the U.S. military really wants to set up situations like that in Kandahar province, in Helmand, in the southern and eastern areas of the country, where you have an American company fighting with an Afghan battalion. And there isn't one of those operational at this point. It's just been taking too long. And when the military planners look at this, they look in increments of 5 to 10 years. When Obama looks at this, and this is part of the reason why this has been, you know, such a complicated process, he wants to know what sort of things can be done in the next year so that we can see whether these things are working.
Yeah.
You know, the military wants to build fortifications in Kandahar City before they send troops in, but there's a huge air base just outside of Kandahar City where you could put heated tents for the moment and get the troops in now while they're building those fortifications. You know, the president wants to see whether or not it's possible to actually train Afghan troops. There's a 20% desertion rate now, which is much, much higher among those Afghan troops, like the 205th Division, who are fighting down in the south where there's actual fighting going on.
Yeah, and then you have this army is also an ethnic mess, where the people who want to fight, are fighting around, I don't know how many hundreds of the Tajik Pashtun War, they're very eager to do that, but they may take the view that, you know, Pashtun is a Pashtun, and they're all the enemy.
That's right. I mean, one of the problems with the 205th is that most of them are Dari speakers, and they need interpreters in the areas that they're occupying right now. So David, I think that the people on both sides of this issue, the people on the left who say we should just get out, I disagree with, because I think that that it's really in our national interest to try and stabilize the situation, and also, more importantly, to send a message to the Pakistanis that we're not bugging out, that we're going to be there, and that we are going to continue to support the civilian government in Pakistan. But the people on the right who say it's 40,000 troops or nothing, or the president is a chicken, you know, I think I disagree with those people as well.
Let me speak up for them. Do you think here that we are seeing this commitment to Afghanistan, a real commitment by the real Obama? Or is this something he stumbled into for campaign purposes 18 months ago that he dearly wishes he could somehow escape and that is being handled in a way that looks about as political, maybe more political, than the thinking about any war since the very early days of Vietnam?
You know, I can understand why people would have that impression, but I disagree with it. When I spoke to Obama about this during the campaign, you know, he had this, and I believe, the right proportion, which was that this is really a Pakistan problem. It's really a South Asian regional problem, and that Afghanistan is the most obvious piece of that. The person that he hired to run the first review, Bruce Rydell, you know, is very much in favor of the McChrystal option, by the way. But he also has said to me, and he's written, that there's a real chance of an Islamist coup in Pakistan. You know, that would put in Islamists. There have been Islamist coups in the past. You know, Benazir Bhutto's father was overthrown by Zia-ul-Huq, who was an Islamist. But if you have Islamists in charge of 80 to 100 nuclear weapons, then this is a very scary world. And I think that the president is really, really fixed on that part of it. Now,
let me stop you.
If
this is a South Asian regional problem, then we can't fix it, right? I mean, because
I don't think that's true.
Solving the India-Pakistan problem, which is like what the Israeli-Arab problem would be if the Israeli-Arab problem were really important. That is so beyond the, and it involves a billion, that is so beyond the capacities of the United States. So if that's the way you're thinking, that's actually, I mean, Obama, it's never stupid, okay? It's not a stupid thing to say, smart thing to say, but it's also a tremendously convenient rationalization for doing nothing, because you've defined the problem in such a way that, look, it's beyond our capacity to solve anyway. So,
but we're not doing nothing.
Well, we're not doing nothing, but my point, what we're doing is we're honoring his campaign commitment, what the right-wing critique of Obama that I have to say I'm very sympathetic to, is he's engaged in, it's like fingernails going down the side of over the cliff edge in one of those Western thrillers. The hero is dragged to a fate he never wanted to go to, but he found himself here for campaign reasons. And in his own mind, this is that Afghanistan is a subset between the negotiations that should be happening between India and Pakistan. It's hopeless, and I'm only here because I needed to say something. I need to find a war to be for, so I didn't look too left-wing in the Democratic primary and the general election.
Well, you know, I think that there are political calculations involved in everything, obviously, and that may have been one of them. But when you look at the policy of it and what he actually believes, I think that he actually believes that we have to be in Afghanistan to prevent it from becoming a safe haven for al-Qaeda. And also, you know, the thing, the policy part of this that you really can't talk about if you're the president of the United States is we have to continue to be in Afghanistan so that the Pakistanis are reassured that Afghanistan isn't going to become an Indian satellite, and that by doing so, we can continue to reinforce the civilian government in Pakistan and not have a military coup of the sort that Rydell is fearful about. Now, the things that we are doing in Pakistan are important, and they are the sort of things that the previous administration didn't do. One very important calculation that we've made, and you and I may disagree with this or may disagree on this or agree, is the way that they've handled the Chinese. The Chinese are absolutely crucial to Pakistan. They are arguably Pakistan's strongest ally. They provide an awful lot of the military support and economic support. And we have lowballed human rights issues with the Chinese in part to encourage them to encourage the Pakistanis to fight the Taliban because the Chinese are also concerned about Islamic radicalism in their western part of the country. So there's been a really comprehensive diplomatic effort that doesn't make it into the news that the Obama administration has been pushing, which I think is really good. You have $7.5 billion in economic aid going to Afghanistan for the first time. You have the drones, which no matter how much the Pakistanis complain about it, they've been helping the target. So there's been that. And I think that there has been far more targeted military aid. The military aid that's gone to Pakistan since this new administration took over, is much more smartly delivered than it was during the Bush administration. It goes to helicopters, night vision equipment, all the things that you need to fight a counterinsurgency rather than, you know, just blanket aid that the Pakistanis then use on the border against India.
One of the things I often think about is if the problem is Pakistan, like, should we, in fact, be leveraging the India situation a little bit more and saying, gee, if this goes badly, we're going to have to get out of here, and the only people who are likely to step into our shoes are, guess who, the Indians. I mean, wasn't India Afghanistan's biggest aid donor back in the 60s and 70s before the Russians?
Right. The Pakistanis are totally paranoid about this. It's not for nothing that the Indian embassy in Kabul has been bombed twice in 2 years. There are all these fantasies going on. When I was in Pakistan last week with Hillary Clinton, one of the constant questions that she was getting was, is it true? Is your intelligence telling you that the Indians are funding the Baluch rebels in western Pakistan? And of course, our intelligence has told us no such thing, at least that I know of. But the Pakistanis are totally paranoid. With some, I mean, even paranoids have real enemies.
Well, isn't it also projection? I mean, if I remember this right, one of the secrets we learned after the Cold War ended was the Soviet chemical warfare program went into high gear in 1952-53, i.e., at exactly the moment when the Soviets were accusing the United States of planning a chemical warfare program. And,
right.
And so Pakistan is a country that has, for years, run a terrorist war against India. And so naturally, what would be more obvious than to assume that the Indians would do the same thing to them?
Right, and it's not beyond the realm of possibility that they're doing it. But to get back to Afghanistan...
If they were doing it, it would be a kind of very rough justice, because I mean, Pakistan has been against India, one of the world's leading state sponsors of terror, and we've never dared say so.
And by the way, the group that brought off the Mumbai terrorist attack really is an adjunct wing of the Pakistani army. I mean, you know, there's no question about that. And far more to our concern is that the Haqqani Madrasa up in North Waziristan, which is causing tremendous trouble for us in the coast region of Afghanistan, the Haqqani Madrasa is also an asset of the ISI, the Inter Services Intelligence Agency, that is the Pakistani intelligence force. And also the Pakistanis are, you know, you don't see any predator strikes going into Quetta, where Mullah Omar, the leader of the religious fanatic part of the Taliban, has his Quetta Shura.
So does this make you want to refine any of your compliments to the Obama administration about the excellence of their Pakistan policy?
What I'm saying is that it's very difficult, and that you have to keep on trying, and that there's a real effort that's being made, and that some progress is being made. Who would have thought that the Pakistanis would actually go into South Waziristan and fight the Taliban there? You know, I was in Pakistan in March, and then I was just back a few weeks ago, and the change in attitude among the Pakistani leadership, I mean, I wouldn't give you a nickel for Zardari. And he conducted one of the stupidest interviews with I've ever been part of with me and David Ignatius and Dexter Filkins from the New York Times in March. I mean, you know, I thought at that point, man, we're not going to be able to get these folks to do anything. But 6 months later, I think that they really now see the terrorist threat as an existential threat to their government. So there's been some progress.
Well, they're blowing up hotels in Pakistani cities, so that would kind of clue you in. But the question there is, are they doing this as allies of the United States, or have the Taliban crossed some, to us, invisible red line that triggers a Pakistani reaction against them, but only for domestic Pakistani reasons? And it's still true that they'd rather see a Taliban government in Afghanistan than a Karzai government, or something like a Karzai government, succeed, because that government would have to have good relations with India.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why the president really feels that he wants to stay in Afghanistan, because if it's apparent that we're not going to run away, that we're going to remain involved in the region, then the Pakistanis may begin to rethink their support for groups like the Haqqani Madrasa or the Quetta Shura. That's at least the hope. You know, I don't know whether the hope is vain or not. It probably is.
Yeah.
But you're going to have to give me an alternative. What's the policy alternative to this?
Oh, I know. Look, the reason I love that, I've always loved that saying that there's no force in politics as strong as a bad idea whose time has come. I mean, that Afghanistan in many ways is a policy exactly the opposite of Iraq. It's a policy that everybody agrees on, but nobody believes in.
Wonderful, David. And you're absolutely right.
And Iraq was the opposite, right? It was intensely controversial, but the people who supported it really thought it would work. This is just, you know, what do we do? I mean, no one has much optimism about it, and no one sees any real alternative. I mean, maybe there are people. I'm not even sure that the left-wing people who criticize the Obama administration are serious. It feels often more like heckling than like a serious proposal, because when you talk to somebody who's from that point of view, who's knowledgeable, and you say, well, what's the strategy, that they just start describing a withdrawal so protracted and gradual that it sounds really not a whole lot different from a continuing commitment. It's more no reinforcements than it is withdrawal.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at, you know, Les Gelb, who I have a lot of respect for, but I disagree with entirely about this, you know, who favors the 10,000 troop option and thinks that the war is a complete waste of time. He still wants to be there for at least the next 3 years.
Right.
Now, you know, in my conversations with my friends in the counterinsurgency cult, I'm kind of an adjunct member of the cult, you know, when you actually start talking battalions and where they should go, I get up to 25,000 troops with them, and then it becomes, you know, less certain on their part. It's just, well, the more troops, the better. But that kind of goes against counterinsurgency doctrine, which says sometimes the more troops, the more force, the worse. What I really think specifically should be done at this point, and I'm not privy to the intelligence. This is just what I get from many conversations with military experts, is that we need to put two combat brigades into Kandahar City immediately. We are losing Kandahar City. We may have already lost it. We've certainly lost the Kandahar suburb. So we need to start doing intense counterinsurgency operations there. We also need a brigade down in Khost, which is under attack from the Haqqani Madrasa. So that's 15,000 troops. And then I would throw in two brigades to train the Iraqi forces, the Afghan forces. And then I would have another strategic review 1 year from now, after the next fighting season begins to wind down, to see whether, A, the counterinsurgency is working in Kandahar, B, whether we're actually able to train Afghan troops or not, C, whether the Karzai administration has done anything to improve its reputation in Afghanistan, D, what the Pakistanis are actually doing with regard to the Taliban, and E, how our human intelligence, which is something I give Bush tremendous credit for, the beefing up of our human intelligence capabilities, how much that's helped us in wiping out al-Qaeda. Those are the five factors that I think should be reviewed a year from now. But, you know, what they, and essentially that troop level is what I favor. What's your plan?
I don't see that there's a whole lot of a practical disagreement. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, when you are, I think that your points are very powerful and valid. The situation with the Afghan government is very depressing. The situation with the Afghan police force is worse than depressing. You know, there are all these surveys about how everybody in Afghan hates the police, mistrusts them, and yet everything we know about winning these kinds of wars say the police are even more important than the military.
And
the
Absolutely.
And the police are the source of intelligence because they're ethnically similar to the people around. I mean, I keep hearing that there is this thing called an Afghan national consciousness, and people who know much more about Afghanistan than I do tell me so. But you know, when you're there, you know, the officers don't look like the Pashtuns. You can sort of tell at a glance who is from
right.
which group. And the officer corps looks like one kind of population, and the Taliban look like a different kind of population. And the police look like the people they live amongst. And that makes you wonder whether the police in the areas where things are worst are not really working for the other side. I have one other question that gnaws at me a lot when I think about this. Which is one of the things that we say is that the way the Taliban finance themselves is through the drug. I mean, we don't say it, it's true. Yet, Taliban finance themselves through the drug. And so the implicit assumption there is that the the drug trade is somehow subordinate to the Taliban. The Taliban are in charge. The drug traders are, businessmen, and the Taliban exploit them, do business with them, but they're separate entities. What I sometimes want, what if it were true that what we're dealing with here is actually narco trafficking, and the Taliban work for the narco traffickers? And your Hellman story makes me think about this. Because one of the things that was going on in Hellman was there were a lot of Taliban attacks on irrigation works. Now, one of the things you do if you're a smart guerrilla is you attack symbols of the government that are unpopular, police stations, and you don't attack symbols of the government that are popular, like irrigation works. So that would seem like the worst possible target for a guerrilla insurgency. But it turns out that the irrigation works are people's exit from the drug culture. Opium is not necessarily a super profitable thing for the farmer, but it doesn't require a lot of water, and wheat does. If you destroy the irrigation works, you force people out of the wheat economy back into the opium economy. That's exactly what a narco trafficker would want to do, not what a guerrilla would want to do. So why are the guerrillas blowing up the irrigation works?
Well, I think that the narco part of this is very interesting. When I was in Helmand last December and I talked to the Brits, I'm sure you were down there too, right?
Yeah.
They were saying that this is not a religious war. This is a drug war. We should always remember the Taliban should be regarded as a plural. You have the religious fanatics under Mullah Omar's sway. You have the narco traffickers. And then you have, the Pashtun nationalists who just don't want strangers in their valley, which is one of the great hopes that we can, convince some of those people that we will happily leave their valleys if they renounce their ties with al-Qaeda and the religious extremists. But I think the way that narcotics traffic works is that both sides profit. The Taliban extracts their profits at the farmer level. They tax the farmers for their for the crops. The Karzai government gets its the friends of the Karzai government, I won't say that the president himself or his government, they get their profits by buying the crop. I mean, don't forget that the former governor of Helmand, Akhundzada, who is, Karzai's biggest ally in the region, in that province, was caught with 9 tons of opium in his compound. I mean, that's astonishing. And yet the guy is still walking free. So I think that your point about the irrigation system, by the way, we're the ones who built that irrigation system in the 1950s, and in the 1950s, Helmand, the Helmand River Valley, was the breadbasket of Afghanistan. I want to tell you a story that Dexter Filkins told me about this, about the Afghan national consciousness that you raised before, versus the Pakistani national consciousness, which is very much a post-British colonial consciousness, which is kind of a bit more servile than the Afghan consciousness. In any case, Filkins got into Afghanistan in the late 90s when the Taliban government were running the show, and almost immediately they kicked him out. They put him in a car with a Taliban driver and 2 hours to the border and sent him away. And Filkins told me, he's a wild man, and he told me, I was so pissed off about that, I was screaming at this driver, about what assholes the Taliban were, and I'm thinking, Dexter, you're out of your mind. But he was screaming for about a half hour, and finally the Taliban driver pulls over to the side of the road and says to him, "Shut up, you're treating me like a Pakistani."
You can't kick us, Sahib.
Right.
Don't kick me,
Sahib.
Well,
we're proud. I mean, you look at the Afghans and they look you straight in the eye. There's no servility at all involved there.
Well, Pakistan's really not a country, right?
It's four different countries.
And the whole, I'm looking here on my bookshelf, there's a really interesting book by a woman named Lal, I think, that argues that the whole existence of Pakistan was a product of some hideous negotiating error by the Muslim
Lord Mountbatten.
Was that not by Lord Mountbatten, but by Jinnah? That what Jinnah wanted there was always this question of what was Pakistan. And we assumed that because Pakistan is now a territorial entity, that that's what Jinnah had in mind. But there are people in his coalition who wanted a territorial entity, and there are people who wanted much more power at the center. And Jinnah always had to keep these people united in his coalition by extreme vagueness as to whether he meant some kind of special status for Muslims within a united India, that's Pakistan, or whether he meant an actual territorial state, that was Pakistan. And she argues that he really preferred the special status but got backed into this outcome, in part because the Congress Party forced him into it, and he was outmaneuvered and stuck with, and he had this famous line that he said, the Pakistan we got is not the Pakistan we wanted. And what did he mean by that? And she argues that what he meant was he wanted something that was like, you know, more like Quebec within Canada than it is like the partition that happened.
And well, you know, that and that plus if Gandhi had gotten his way and had Jinnah as the first prime minister of India, Pakistan, that might have proved things as well. You know,
maybe, or who knows, maybe made them worse.
Yeah, I'm a stone Anglophile. I think you are too, right?
The Anglophile means applauding their decisions, yeah, usually no, but if it means being really interested in their political system, then yes.
And enraptured by their culture and their writing and their TV series. But I think that whenever it came to drawing lines, they cause a hell of a lot of trouble. Yeah. I mean, almost every one of the straight lines that you see in the region you know, is a British line, the Durand line, and the borders of Iraq and Jordan, and so on. And you know, we're still recovering from you know, the British colonial experience in that region. I guess that gets us so high and far from the day's events that we probably should quit at this point. But it's been a lot of fun.
All right, it's great to talk to you, and I'm glad your cell phone served so well. We got such a great signal from it, and it's a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll all be looking forward to reading more of your unbelievable sourcing and your contacts through the national security community. I am always fascinated to see, to sort of do the reverse engineering and to say, now, where did this come from? Where did that come from? So someday you'll maybe leave one of those diagrams around so that we can all trace the process of construction.
Oh no, I won't.
All right, nice to talk to you. Bye bye.
It was great to talk to you as always, Dave.